Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I am your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is a serial entrepreneur, product evangelist, and a combat-decorated Air Force pilot. He started his career in the Air Force before moving into software and entrepreneurship back in the 1990s, when he co-founded Trio Development, which was later acquired by Apple. He is now the co-founder and CEO of Smartling, a translation software and service company helping ambitious brands access more markets. In this conversation, we discuss cocktail entrepreneurs, why everybody's job is marketing and sales, and why every team needs a leader. Now, let's hack Jack Weldy. Do you know what drives the value of your business? Is it customers? Is it contracts? Is it culture? To really understand this, we need insights into our customers, clients, and markets. And to do this simply and beautifully, we need Typeform. Or more simply, you and your business needs Typeform. Typeform is versatile, and you can use it at every stage of your funnel, from research to lead generation to just simply selling stuff with the Stripe integration. You can have tutorials, quizzes, even FAQs if you're short on support staff. The results don't lie. Typeform has a 57% completion rate on surveys. That goes against the industry average of about 20%, according to SurveyGizmo. That's more data for you to play with, and more data to understand what drives the value of your business. Typeform also integrates with your favorite tools, including Google Sheets, MailChimp, Airtable, and hundreds more. And you can also collect data through Facebook Messenger with their Typeform chat feature. Remember, what you ask matters. How you ask is everything. Join former President Barack Obama and myself in making data collection a little more human. Sign up for free today. Plus, there's a special offer for you as a Hack the Entrepreneur listener. You can upgrade to their pro plan and you'll get 30% off for 6 months. Go to typeform.com/hack. They have absolutely excellent support staff and help center to get you going fast. Remember, when collecting data, remember one rule. Put people first, data second. And, I mean, ironically enough, you'll get all the data you could possibly need. Once again, to get that special offer, go to typeform.com/hack. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very, very special guest to the show. Jack, welcome.
Thanks, John. Delighted to be here.
Absolutely my pleasure. I have a feeling it's going to be a lot of fun. I've been looking forward to this conversation, and I think we should just jump straight into it. What do you think?
Yeah, me too. Looking forward to it.
All right.
Let's do it.
Jack, you are a man with a very varied past. Today, though, we are talking to Jack, the entrepreneur. As an entrepreneur, Jack, can you tell me, what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
Yeah, so I'm a fan of your podcast, and I know that this is a question that you like to ask, so I was thinking about this one a little bit, and I think I'm going to go with my very standard answer that I think is really the epitome of entrepreneurship. I like this. You know, we talked earlier that I've got a background in the U.S. military as well. And I like this George S. Patton, this General Patton quote that says, a good plan today is better than a perfect plan tomorrow. And to me, I think that really epitomizes entrepreneurship. And it's the idea that as an entrepreneur, you do not have unlimited resources. In many cases, you are bringing a brand new to the world product or service that is, by definition, it's something new. At a minimum, it's a new company, but it may also could be something completely new to the world. And who knows how the market's going to react to you, to your company, to your product, to your service. And so a lot of people, I think, think, well, gosh, I've got to make it perfect. But I like this quote that says, a good plan today is better than a perfect plan tomorrow, because it really allows the entrepreneur to try to figure out what's good enough. What's good enough? How do I get something to market and get immediate feedback from the market that is better than me, you know, spending more time boiling the ocean and dotting every I and crossing every T to really try to figure out, you know, the perfect product? Because guess what? You're never going to get that perfect product. Markets change, competition changes, customers change. So how do you, you know, how do you draw a line to say this is good enough? There's a lot of strategies around sort of MVP, minimal viable products, and trying to get it to market quicker. But I really like this idea of good today being better than perfect tomorrow, because, you know, it prevents you from really focusing on that elusive, you're never going to reach that perfect thing. Get it to market, get it out there, start selling it, start getting people to use it, start getting feedback, and then rapidly iterate from there.
I like it. And I've heard the quote before, and I don't think I've ever, I guess, put it in line with George S. Patton and the military. So this is cool. And
actually, John, if you really want to know, the super interesting thing about this is I actually misquoted there. The real quote says, a good plan today, comma, violently executed, comma, is better than a perfect plan tomorrow.
That part out.
That's right. But here's what's so fascinating about it is this violently executed, you know, doesn't necessarily mean what you might think it means. Literally, it means, you know, in an entrepreneurship context, it means, am I not just putting out a minimal viable product? Hey, let me find the smallest set of features I can put out there and start to get feedback. But it means I also need to be able to iterate rapidly. Look, if you put out a small feature set product and put it out in the market and just leave it there for a couple of years, all you've really done is just ship a crappy product. But if you can iterate very, very rapidly, if every single week, day, hour, you are adding more features and capabilities, you are listening to your customers, you are asking your customers and going there visiting with them and saying, you know, hey, what do you think about this? Do you like this? What would you add to this? And then be able to do that very, very rapidly. That to me is violent execution in an entrepreneurship context. Being able to listen, hear the market feedback, and then make changes very, very rapidly ahead of competitors. That's how you take a product, you know, that's new to the world and very quickly, you know, find a way to satisfy your customer's goal. So that's what I really love about that particular quote. And that's what I think really resonates with me.
Yeah, very, very well said. And you answered a question I was going to ask, which was, this wasn't just for the launch of this new product. This literally is the iterative process you're going to use throughout the lifespan.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, every modern company, particularly software-oriented companies, are focused on agile. They're focused on agile development methodologies. They're focused on creating content at a very rapid rate in tiny, smaller batches. You know, think back to 20 years ago, software companies were creating products that they would conceive of and then build and then test and do sort of a waterfall development process that would take years, you know, and then you came up with products that had a year in its title, like Windows 95, Windows 98. By the way, you know, if your product has a year in the name, you're not agile. You know, now in 2017, you know, companies are creating code changes, new content on a weekly, daily, hourly basis. And we see that in our everyday lives. Think about the number of times that your apps are automatically updated on your iPhone or your Android device because companies are creating that really rapid iteration. And so that, I think, that speaks to exactly this idea, which is, have an expectation that you as an entrepreneur are going to be rapidly updating and modifying your product and listening to the market. Because guess what? That's what the market in 2017 wants and frankly expects.
Exactly. And the app is a great example, or apps on our phones are a great example. And I do sort of want to push it with the iteration and sort of how you've evolved with SmartLing. But something near the beginning of your first answer that you said, Jack, was interesting to me, and I'd like to kind of dive into it a bit.
Yeah.
Which was, you said when you're putting something new out, right? Like, you have this thing that you're putting out to the world, and you said that could even be, like, it doesn't have to be a unique product necessarily. It could just be the fact that you're launching a new business. So I'm assuming in that you meant sort of like A business doesn't have to necessarily be based on a 100% unique idea, product, service. You can sort of, do you believe that you can sort of create just an iterative process on an existing product or service? And sort of how far does that have to be, like, in the unique realm to make it a viable business?
Yeah, boy, there's a lot there to unpack. I'll throw out a couple of different ideas here. I think for one thing, there are a lot of what I would call sort of cocktail party entrepreneurs. I mean, entrepreneurship is hot. It has been hot. A lot of people want to be entrepreneurs. They like the idea of entrepreneurship. But they're cocktail party entrepreneurs. You know, they haven't really launched their business. They haven't set up their website. They haven't gone and conceived of a product. They haven't set up a Shopify site. They haven't raised venture capital. They haven't hired developers, but they like talking about at cocktail parties that, oh yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. I've got a pretty hot idea that I'm thinking about and whatever. And my point of view is launch it. Like, get to the point as quickly as possible where you can get it out there and launch it, and then start having conversations with people. And people come up with all kinds of different excuses. Well, we're in stealth mode. We don't really want to reveal to the world. I trust me, 20 other people have had the same idea that you've had. Maybe better, but execution is really where the rubber meets the road on this. So that's sort of one extreme. The other extreme would be something like what Smartling has done. So just very briefly, Smartling is a company that is focused on building and delivering to our customers software that helps them to use data and technology to translate better, to translate their digital content, their websites, their mobile apps, their emails, their marketing materials, their support content into, you know, 10, 20, 50 other spoken languages. So we help companies to use software and technology and data to translate, let's say, their English content into French, Spanish, Italian, German, Chinese, Hebrew, whatever. You know, that translation has been done forever. You know, it's been done, you know, forever. For as long as there's been writers, there have been translators. And so, you know, what are we doing that is different? Well, instead of emailing that Word document over to a translation agency and then having them email that Word document over to a smaller translation agency and having them email that to a translator perhaps working out of his or her home in Paris, you know, we've built a cloud-based translation management system that integrates directly with all of the places that companies are creating content in 2017, in their content management systems, in their e-commerce platforms, in their marketing platforms, in their support platforms, in their file repositories, like, say, you know, Box, Dropbox, et cetera, directly integrating there so that when content is created, we can automatically capture it, organize it, route it, layer all kinds of important metadata over the top of it, and then route it directly to the human translator who's going to be doing that translation. Now, you could say that's evolutionary. You could say it's, you know, because, hey, it's still translation that's happening at some point. You're just, you know, you're changing the plumbing and you're changing the process and you're changing the data collection that goes with it. You could say it's revolutionary because it happens a lot faster. It happens with a lot of additional data. It happens with, you know, any number of different things. And, you know, I don't really want to argue with people about evolutionary versus revolutionary, but what is important to me as an entrepreneur is get it out there and then continue to perfect that product, add the features, add the capabilities, improve the product experience by listening to your customers and hearing what they have to say about it. Either one of those things, you know, the main message there, launch, get it out there, minimal viable product, and then build as quickly as possible on top of it on a continuous ongoing basis.
Right. And so I see, if you want to call them cocktail entrepreneurs. I mean,
that's worked for us. That's worked for us.
Right, exactly. And so it's, to me, I'm just like trying to understand that I think that lots of times people, when they don't launch, is because they're trying to come up with the new Uber. That's like a unique idea where you're kind of putting two ideas together and making something unique. And they're just stuck constantly waiting for that rather than coming up with like, well, this is a cool business. I'm going to just do it different or better in some way. And just even if that's just my first business to start with. But when you talk about, I mean, Smartling, I mean, you're almost 9 years into it, right? So
yeah,
I'm sure it was way different when you launched. And like, what did the competitive sort of landscape look like in your market when you launched compared to now?
Yeah, it looked like, you know, it looked like 26,000 translation agencies, small businesses. And by the way, like, most of these are filled with entrepreneurs. So respect for the fact that it's translators and it's translators who have become business owners and are entrepreneurs and building their own, you know, their own small business, but super fragmented market and not nearly the focus on technology and data and workflows and analytics and machine learning that I think we and a handful of other companies have brought to the market. And, you know, in the early days of SmartLing, we were pushing this concept of the cloud, that you need a centralized place to manage all of your translations, all of your global content, really. And you need integrations into all of the different places where you're creating content as a company. That was pretty foreign to an awful lot of the industry, to most of the industry, in fact. And there was a real sort of sense of, you know, would you really trust your translations and your data to the cloud? That doesn't sound like the kind of thing we do in this industry, you know, despite the fact that every other industry, all the way through banking and, you know, and any other sort of really sensitive industry has moved to the cloud for all the benefits that you get from that. And so for a lot of people in my industry, in the translation and localization industry, this was pretty foreign. So how did we do that? Well, we started with a website, and I personally coded a lot of the original application. And I then, you know, asked colleagues to come and join me. And I, you know, did the typical thing that entrepreneurs do, which is basically call your buddy every single hour, every single day, and try to get them to work for free and get them to build something. Hey, did you build that thing for me yet? No, because I have a day job. Well, what about tonight? What about this weekend? And then slowly but surely, we started putting a little money into it. We hired some developers. We expanded our operations. Year in or so, I stopped doing any kind of day-to-day development. And eventually, my technology team managed to pull every single line of code that I ever coded out of the system and completely locked me out of the system, which was smart.
Yeah.
But look, I think it starts with, this was our example, but there are just so many tools available today, whether it's Shopify for setting up an instant storefront, whether it's some of the logo design services like 99designs and others, whether it's, you know, whether it's I need some cloud hosting someplace, you can turn that on with AWS. Instantly, there are so many interesting things that you can do. You've got social networks. You've got an incredible array of things that you can do. And honestly, like Uber is a once in a generation kind of idea. And if you're waiting for that to happen, or worse, in my view, if you're saying, you know, I had that idea 10 years ago, and you know that sort of thing that people like to say, well, then shame on you. You should have executed on it. You should have tried it. You should have started it. And you know, maybe you did, maybe you were too early to the market, but the only way you'll know, in my opinion, and what's worked for me, is get it out there. Put something out there that, as they like to say, is a little bit embarrassing because it's not fully formed yet, and give the market a chance to take a look at it or ridicule it or critique it or say, hey, this is really pretty awesome. And then listen to that feedback and then make modifications accordingly, or stick to whatever the vision is that you have and ignore any of the naysayers. That's worked for me.
So you wrote the first lines of code. You hustled, got people to help you write more lines of code and sort of build out the first product. Were you also the one sort of out there hustling to get the first customers?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the CEO's job. And I think everybody's job in a company is sales. And I think everybody's job in the company is marketing. And I think, especially as an early startup, whatever it is that you're doing, whatever the size is, I think the entrepreneur, the CEO, the founder, I think it's their responsibility to go drive sales. And so, yes, I did that. In fact, what we did is I had friends and colleagues, and I had a certain skill set with sales and with software, and I had some money that I could put into this. And we had enough that we could start to get this thing going. But we knew that if we were going to build what we wanted to build, we were going to have to go out and raise venture capital. And so we set the milestones. We said, okay, in order to go out and raise a seed round, I need to be able to accomplish A, B, and C. In order to be able to go out and raise a Series A, I need to have 5 customers paying us at least this much money per month or per year. And they need to be able to say something like, boy, this was really instrumental into what we were trying to accomplish, and we plan on continuing to use it. And so just having those goals of, you know, 5 customers doing this, you know, with these kinds of parameters led to what was the next milestone, whether it's a funding round, whether it's, you know, a certain number of customers, whether it's a deal size or whatever. But yeah, the short answer to your question is absolutely. I mean, it takes hustle. And, you know, for me, I like selling. I like being involved in the product. I like being involved in the technology. I like hearing that customer feedback because that, frankly, helps me to to understand what customers want and be able to morph the product accordingly.
Yeah, exactly. And I agree that everybody's job is marketing and sales to some degree, and especially as the CEO. But just hearing you with like putting together the team, writing the first lines of code, did you like by title, of course, but did you sort of by mindset position yourself as the quote unquote CEO from the very beginning, even when it was just you?
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, it wasn't me for very long. I brought in a co-founder fairly quickly who is a more traditional CTO type, a more traditional chief technology officer and an architect and a friend and colleague that I'd worked with for many years previously. And he and I, and fortunately for us, in a very brief set of conversations, we agreed pretty quickly that I would be the CEO and he would be the CTO. You know, I do know that other folks struggle with this, but, you know, look, this is probably my military background shining through again, which says in any team size of two or more people, one person is the leader. And if you don't have that, that's a problem. I don't really personally understand how some of these companies operate that have two co-CEOs or, you know, there's not really a CEO and it's done by committee. Somebody's got to make the hard decisions. And, you know, even at SmartLing and even in every other company that I think has run really well, no matter what the team size is, whether you're the CEO of the company, you're a department lead, you're a team lead, you're a, you know, an individual contributor, I think you need leadership at every single level, even down to the individual contributor. You're closest to many of these projects and many of these customers. And, you know, my opinion is that, you know, you have a leadership opportunity there. So yeah, from the early days, that's what we did.
Every team needs a leader, even if you have two or more people.
Even if you have two or more people, one person's got to be the leader.
It makes sense when you think of it in a military sense. I mean, you go into any sort of situation and somebody has to be in charge.
Yeah.
And I think we sort of take that for granted when we start businesses, and especially sort of come up with departments within it. And it's like kind of just, well, everyone will kind of run it and it doesn't work.
Which, I don't think it does.
Right. Which leads us into projects, which is a loose term, Jack, but let's maybe talk, because we talked about iteration sort of with the product side, let's talk this marketing side of it. And depending on, I'm not sure what your team looks like for the marketing side of it, but do you as the CEO run that department, or is there somebody in charge of it that you make the leader? And I would also just like to know sort of how you guys are determining marketing channels. How do you decide on a new marketing channel and that you're going to run with it?
Yeah. So first of all, to answer your question, everyone in my department has a team lead, you know, head of sales, head of marketing, head of engineering, head of product. You know, I have VPs for all of these different departments. I like to play an active role in departments. If there's something that I can add of value, if there's something that we're really focused on, I tend to come from a product background and from an engineering background. And so I tend to lean in those directions, but I also am super interested in sales and I'm super interested in retaining customers and making sure that they don't churn. But I have I think there's two parts to your question. What's your team look like and how do they operate? And then how do you think about in making investments in marketing programs? You know, on the first one, I think I have a fairly laissez-faire approach to leadership. I try my best not to micromanage. I'm sure every leader micromanages a little bit too much, but I would rather set a handful of objectives and say, you know, look, this quarter we're trying to hit these revenue, bookings, expense, product, hiring, or whatever goals. And that's what we're focused on. And then, you know, every day we have a leadership team stand-up meeting for 15 minutes where we basically focus on every department head says, does two things. What are the big three things that I did yesterday and the big three things that I'm working on today? What does big three mean? Whatever you think is big enough that it warrants you talking about it in front of your colleagues that you were doing to try to move the business forward. And then what's the one metric, you know, that to report on for your department? For sales, it might be, hey, we've got this number of bookings against a quarterly target of X. For market, it might be, hey, we've generated this many leads at a quarterly target of Y, something like that. And honestly, if everybody knows the objectives, if they know what the metrics are, then I trust my people to go out and execute on those things. And when we're not doing it for any number of reasons, that's typically where I'm going to want to understand what's going on and I'm going to want to dig into it. Was that the answer to sort of the first part of your question?
Yeah, it is. It was a really good answer.
Oh, thank you.
It's sort of, so you sort of have the overarching goals and metrics you're trying to hit for maybe quarterly or yearly for the team or for the company. And then the departments themselves run the individual team to hit those metrics.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's in a perfect world. That's the way it works. Nothing ever works perfectly. Good plan today, perfect plan tomorrow. But that's why we get started and we talk about it. And if it turns out that something is going off the tracks, then we figure out, you know, are we able to course correct as quickly as possible? Let me answer your second question, John, which is, you know, how do you think about marketing programs? Boy, there are just so many incredible programs that you could run. You can, you know, you could run Google Ads, you could run webinars, you could do, you know, go to a seminar, you could go to conferences, you can do ad retargeting, you can advertise on different sites, you can, you know, there's so many different things that you can do. And some of them cost different amounts of money. Some of them are going to be more effective than others. And my point of view on this is, for a company of our size, and we're starting to get up there, I would say we're not, you know, a three-person company working out of a garage anymore. What I would say is, for a company of our size, we know that we need to make some sort of marketing investment that is not insignificant. So we spend real dollars. We spend real dollars on marketing on a monthly basis. But the way that we think about it is, we try to be really thoughtful about our ideal customer profile. What does that buyer look like? Where do they work? What are their titles? What are the problems they're trying to solve? Where do they hang out? What do they read? What conferences do they go to? Where do they, you know, what parts of the world are they living in? And then how can we reach them? And in some cases, the answer is, let's run Google Ads. In some cases, the answer is, let's run some things on LinkedIn that are designed to get people to say, this looks interesting, let me click on this and learn more. In some cases, we sponsor conferences. In some cases, we'll do a dinner. The dinners are something I really like. I like dinners where you go to a nice restaurant and, you know, you're spending money here for sure, but, you know, where software, the types of software and the packages that people buy typically make this a very worthwhile marketing investment. But when you get a group of people around a dinner, that, and you not, don't make it a sales dinner, you make it more of a, you've got a speaker, it's relatively intimate with about 12 people total, and you make it more of a discussion and a learning opportunity, you know, with both clients and prospects. And, you know, at some point, somebody's going to go, this seems pretty interesting, I might want to learn more about that. And if a couple people do that, that dinner is just paid for itself. So, you know, the way we think about spending money on marketing is, we really try to be thoughtful and have a thesis about, we're going to spend this money and we think it's going to do the following. And then we do it. And we're totally open to a culture of experimentation. Let's try it out and see what happens. And if it works, let's do more of it. If it doesn't work, let's do less of it. If it's, we're not sure, let's keep running it for a little longer and see what happens from there. That's our point of view on it. And sometimes we waste money. Sometimes we spend really awesome marketing dollars that really move the needle for the business.
So dinners being one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's physical. You're, as a technology software company, it's,
yeah,
it's a different approach. But I mean, it's been said that sort of doing those things that don't scale. I mean, you can physically only do so many dinners no matter what, but it can be a great way.
Challenge accepted, John. I'm happy to go to a dinner every night of the year.
But that's still only one, right? It's not, you can automate the process. I mean, if you can scale out an AdWords campaign to like an email sequence getting people to sign up, it's virtually limitless, as long as you can find the people. But
I think that depends on your ideal customer profile, your ICP. And so what we're selling is, we're selling enterprise software. We're selling enterprise software to big businesses and small businesses who have translation requirements. They're creating a lot of content very frequently with a product that has global appeal, and they need help being able to translate that content. We're selling them enterprise software. And for us, you know, the Google Ads may not be the most effective way of doing it. Now, if I was selling t-shirts, or if I was selling an item that was more sort of a B2C type of item, or if I was, you know, selling a rideshare type of thing, I would have a completely different marketing strategy. Obviously, Uber is not taking everybody to dinner and saying, hey, you know, I might want to try an alternative to a taxi and you might like this. So it really depends on what it is. For B2B enterprise software, I think it's still hand-to-hand combat. I think it's relationship-based. I think it is, there's more one-on-one or one-on-small groups really understanding, hey, what are you trying to solve? What is the problem you're having? And do we potentially have a solution that might help you to solve that? And do you have budget available and everything else? I think it's more relationship focused. Of course, we advertise on Google. Of course, we advertise on LinkedIn. Of course, we do a lot of the things that help with our overall brand awareness. And certainly we get people that click on an ad on Google and show up and buy, you know, a very large enterprise software package, and we're delighted by that. But in general, I think, you know, for our type of business, I think those more intimate, personalized, relationship-based, you know, the hand-to-hand combat tends to work a little bit better.
Excellent distinction. Because the whole enterprise level, I mean, it's high touch because of sort of the price tag on it, but you can afford to spend that time with each potential customer.
That's right.
Rather than, like you said, if you're selling a t-shirt, it's, I mean, you can't really have dinners to sell t-shirts, because even if you sell 20 of them, it's not going to pay for dinner and drinks.
100%.
So is this is sort of the approach you've taken since the beginning, and now you can just sort of, I guess, scale it out to certain degrees? Like, there's only one CEO in that way, and I'm assuming, or maybe I'm wrong, but would you have sort of team leads in place in the marketing department to start running, say, two dinners a night or three dinners a night?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we have an event tonight. We have a cocktail event tonight that will be in our office, and we'll probably have 25 people there, and we'll have a speaker, terrific speaker for one of our customers who's, you know, it's not selling. It's really more, it is an educational process with cocktails, which who doesn't want to go learn something and drink some nice cocktails, right?
Exactly.
So, and we hope and assume that at some point somebody will lean over to one of our clients or one of our folks that are there and say, hey, this looks interesting. I'm in the market, but I won't be there tonight. I've got a different event that I'm going to tonight, and I have an amazing marketing team that will be there, and I'll have a few folks from my account management team that will be there, and they'll all do a great job. So I like what you said earlier about do things that don't scale. I think oftentimes it's too easy to just sort of assume, if I buy these ads on Google, if I shotgun out these 4,000 emails, if I do whatever, then people will automatically show up. If you build it, they will come. And I think, for my business, in my experience, that hasn't worked as well. And I like going to conferences. I like meeting people. I like hearing what their concerns are. And I like getting that feedback, for good or bad, about what they like about my company, my product, my service, the people on my team, and everything else. Because then I can make adjustments or keep doing what we're doing.
So well said. So well said. All right, Jack, this has been an absolute blast.
Definitely.
I do want to wrap up on one final question for you, if I could.
Yeah.
It's this idea I'm working with calling the entrepreneurial gap, which, as entrepreneurs, as dreamers, I feel that we sort of live in this gap between where we see ourselves as successful and sort of where we are today. And no matter the goals or metrics you set for 3 months from now or 6 months from now, the second before you hit those goals, you're going to set bigger, loftier ones into the future. So listeners are out there listening to you, just looking up to you and wanting to be in that position, yet you are probably looking to the future for the next goal, which I agree we need to do, but we get stuck in this place where we never seem to achieve it. So right now, for this one moment, I would love if you could stop, turn around, and look behind you. You've been at this game since right out of college, and then through the military, and started multiple businesses. But I would love just for you to tell me how you feel about the highs, the lows, the wins, and the losses of your journey up until today.
Wow, that's a heavy question for the end, but I love it. I love this question. You know, entrepreneurship is tough. It is not for everyone. It's tough. There are definitely highs. There are definitely lows. And I would say the highs are higher and the lows are lower. And when you get that, you know, the thrill of the hunt and the chase and the kill of, you know, we landed that big, huge deal. And how awesome is that? Like, that's a pretty big high and everybody's excited about it. And then when you lose that deal that you thought was yours, boy, that's awful. And I think that entrepreneurs have to be natural optimists. I'm a natural optimist. I think they've got to sort of assume that great things are going to happen in the future, despite the fact that today may have had three really terrible things happen from here. You know, I keep I did turn around as you asked me to. I'm standing here and I'm looking at my sort of the table in my office right by my couch here, and it's called Private Islands Magazine. It's a little bit of a joke. Like, when people come in, you know, to meet with me, that there's this magazine called Private Islands Magazine sitting right there, as if I'm going to go shop and go buy my private island. I don't think that's ever going to happen. And I sort of joke with my family that, you know, on these days when I'm traveling and it's crazy and whatever, that, man, I just want to go sit on the beach for about 3 or 4 years, you know, once this thing is all done. But the reality is, I know me, I would go do it for 2 weeks. And by then I'd be like, I got a great idea. I want to go start another company.
I love it because it is absolutely, I think it's what's in our DNA and which pushes us like that. I love the Private Lens magazine and that you have that. And I agree, we have to always be striving for more because that's what pushes us and gets us out of bed in the morning.
But totally.
I'm so thankful that you stopped and gave us that sort of look back for now. So, Jack, we've got to talk about SmartLing just sort of in passing. Could you specifically tell the listener what SmartLing does and who it's for?
Yeah, we use technology and data to help companies to drive better translation outcomes. That's sort of a one sentence way of saying we use software, technology, data to be able to translate digital content more efficiently than just emailing it off to a translation agency and then trying to figure out how to put it back into all of your different various digital content systems. Companies are creating content in lots of different systems, content management systems, e-commerce systems, marketing platforms, et cetera. And we can capture all that content as it's being created. We can route it to translators around the world. We can have them translate that content in really high quality. We understand the full context of, is it an appearance out of a website, a mobile app, an email, a support document. We make sure it's done with the right terminology for your business. And we use machine learning to score the quality or the likely quality of that translation so that companies can be assured that this is going to be on brand and they're going to be able to reach their customers around the world, whether they prefer English, French, Spanish, Italian, Chinese, Japanese, whatever language they prefer. That's what we do for our customers.
Very cool. And we can track it down where?
SmartLing.com, SmartLing.com.
Very cool. Plus, you are fairly active on Twitter, where you can find at JWelde, so JWelde, and also on LinkedIn. I will have links for those in the show notes for you back on Hack the Entrepreneur, so you can find them easily, as well as links to SmartLing.com.
Terrific.
So, Jack, it's been an absolute blast. I absolutely...
Super fun. Great questions, John.
Yeah, it's been good. Thanks for sharing so openly. And thanks for stopping by. And please just keep doing what you're doing because it's awesome to watch.
You too. You have a great podcast. Thanks so much.
It's time to understand what drives the value of your business. And to really understand this, you need insights into your customers, your clients, and your markets. And to do this simply and beautifully, you need Typeform. Right now, you can sign up absolutely for free at typeform.com/hack. And as a Hack the Entrepreneur listener, you can upgrade to their pro plan and get 30% off for the first 6 months. Go now and sign up for absolutely for free at typeform.com/hack. All right, so as much fun as that was, I would say that the best still lies ahead of us. It was a great conversation with Jack. I really enjoyed it. We got to touch on some really interesting topics and things we don't necessarily always cover on the show. And I like sort of his veteran in entrepreneurship perspective on a lot of things, especially software and development in that sense. But as we go back, which we're going to do now, I went through the conversation looking for something that just sort of grabbed me. And so I had to go back and then I had to go back again. And then I went back one more time through the conversation. That third time back through the conversation, there was something that Jack said that I don't know how I'd missed it, but I did. But that third time through, it was there. It struck me. It was the one thing. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
This is probably my military background shining through again, which says in any team size of two or more people, one person is the leader. And if you don't have that, that's a problem. I don't really personally understand how some of these companies operate that have two co-CEOs or there's not really a CEO and it's done by committee. Somebody's got to make the hard decisions.
And that's the hack. Jack, Jack, Jack. I love this. This is crucial to us. This is crucial to me. This is crucial to you out there listening. Because as you know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, I'm a huge supporter and proponent of having partnerships, starting partnerships, working with people on your ideas to get them going. People who have skill sets and strengths and weaknesses, but that are opposite to yours so that they can fill in that part of the business, that part of the idea, that part of the company. But we run into things because if we start as a partnership and there's two of us and we're the only two working at the beginning, I think if we do the 50-50 partnership, which I'm all for in an equity sort of sense, there needs to be somebody in charge, right? Otherwise, it is this whole by committee and nothing really happens. And there could be two slightly different visions. So this is crucial, right? With any team size of two or more people, one person needs to be the leader. Otherwise, you run into a problem without that defined leader. So this is a huge part of deciding on who your partner should be and what sort of the stakes should be in it. One of you needs to be in charge. Not when you get to 5 people or 10 people or 20 people or 30 people, but when there's 2 or more people in this organization, somebody has to be designated the leader. Jack, thank you very, very much. All right. This was a lot of fun. Remember, it's time for you to stop moving in a million different directions. And if you're ready to take control of your life, take control of your business, especially as we head into this new year, and as I call it, define your 20, that 20% in your life, in your business, in your day, in your week, in your month, in your quarters, in your years of 2018 heading into it, finding that 20% that will give you the 80% of the results and will push you to where you want to be. If that's the case, I've made a course for you, video, and there's actually a book that I wrote in it that you get, and it will show you exactly how to set up your days, weeks, months, years, quarters to do this, to define that 20% that will give you that 80% of results. If that sounds like you, I think you'll really dig it. Hacktheentrepreneur.com/DYT, which is define your 20. That's hacktheentrepreneur.com/DYT. All right, it's been fun. Thank you so much for stopping by. If you ever have any questions or comments for me, I'd love to hear them. john@hacktheentrepreneur.com is my email. And feel free. Just my inbox is ready for you. You're the person I want to hear from. All right, it's been fun. I won't take any more of your time, but please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.